I'm Andrea Loyan, Vermont Edition producer, and I just wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening, and enjoy!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Each week in February, we've explored a different aspect of Black life in our region as a way to commemorate Black History Month. We've talked to Black entrepreneurs about running their own businesses, politicians who are shaping local government, and restaurateurs and home cooks keeping Black food traditions alive. Today, we'll look at Black life in Vermont through the lens of arts and culture. Later in the show, we'll talk with a Bennington College professor who teaches about spirituals and gospel music. We'll also hear the endlessly creative poet, musician, and maker Toussaint St. Negritude from the Northeast Kingdom. But first, since it is Black History Month, let's look to the past at some of the key figures who helped shape Black life in our region today. Here to guide us is Bill Hart, a professor emeritus of history at Middlebury College. He was the first director of their Black Studies program, which began in the early 1990s. He's taught and written widely about Black Americans and Native Americans during the colonial and early Republic eras. He's currently writing biographies of two Black Middlebury graduates from the 19th century, Alexander Twilight and Martin Freeman. He's also working on a documentary film about Black life in 19th century New England. Bill, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Such a pleasure.
You are working on a documentary film about the lives of five 19th century Black New Englanders. I'd like to hear a little bit about each of them. But first, could you tell us what is the thread that you see connecting all five of these people?
Thank you for giving me this chance to talk about this documentary, which we are calling A Peculiar Freedom. I'm working with the Norwich filmmaker Nora Jacobson and also Natasha Negeza, who is a film professor here at Middlebury College, and also with Reggie Jackson, not the ball player.
I was going to say.
Retired professor from Simmons College. So what we're trying to do in this film is to show that for 19th century free Black Americans, they did not live lives of full unfettered freedom. And that's hence our title, A Peculiar Freedom. Because of burgeoning racism, burgeoning white supremacy, each one of our characters was able to achieve only so much. Their lives were limited, as I said, by these white attitudes toward Blackness. So in order to examine this, we begin with Lucy Terry Prince, who's from Guilford, Vermont, quite a remarkable woman. She is the author of the first spoken word poem crafted by an African-American called Bar's Fight. She crafted that in 1746 when she was enslaved in Deerfield, Massachusetts. But she lived a long life as a free woman, a landowner. But here's an example of a woman who's strived to live as a free person, but because of racism, lived a kind of constricted life.
You said that her poem, Bar's Fight, was spoken word. How do we have record of it today?
It was published about 100 years later in a local newspaper in Springfield, Vermont. And so this is handed down by oral history, of course. And so tradition has it that Lucy Prince is the author of this poem, which is an eyewitness account of an Indian raid on Deerfield in 1746 that she watched.
Another one of the people who you are profiling is named Martin Freeman, who's from Rutland, Vermont. Can you tell us about Martin?
Martin Freeman is a very interesting character. Grew up in Rutland, lived with his grandfather, who opened up a potash factory in Rutland in the 1790s. And he was considered a very bright, young, precocious young boy growing up in Rutland. By the early 1840s, abolitionists in Middlebury became critical of Middlebury not enrolling young Black men. So to address this criticism, President Labory of Middlebury worked with Martin Freeman's pastor in Rutland, educated him enough so that he could be enrolled into Middlebury College, which he matriculated into in 1845. And Martin Freeman was the brightest in his class. So when he graduated in 1849, he graduated salutatorian. There was no valedictorian accolade at that time. It was salutatorian was the number one in your class. But eventually in 1850, he was offered a teaching position in Pittsburgh and became president of Allegheny Institute and Mission College, a Mission Church. Became president, first black president in the country to preside over a college. It was one of the early historically black colleges and only lasted a few decades, but he was still the first one. But while there in Pittsburgh, he became friends with black nationalists like Martin R. Delaney, who started to advocate black immigration out of the United States. The 1850s was a very tough decade for African Americans. So the black intelligentsia in the 1850s began to think maybe the United States is not a great place to live. And Martin Freeman in Pittsburgh, college president, was the subject of white racism there and black indifference in the black community. So he quit his job in 1863 with the promise that the American Colonization Society would transport him to Liberia and he would teach at Liberia College. He took his family and he lived and taught in Monrovia, Liberia from 1864 till he died in 1889. But here's an example of an educated young man, Middlebury College, expected to be treated like any other Middlebury man with the accolades and the rights and privileges that go along with having a Middlebury degree. And yet he wasn't accorded those privileges and rights in the United States.
Well, one more story that you have researched for this project is the story of Loudon Langley of Hinesburg. Tell us about Loudon Langley.
Loudon Langley was one of those black families that grew up on Lincoln Hill in Hinesburg. Locals then, and even in the 20th century, often referred to it in a pejorative term using the N-word before Hill. And he is a very interesting character. When the Civil War came, he decided he needed to make a contribution to the Civil War. So we find him joining the Massachusetts 54th, I believe, and eventually winding up down in South Carolina, where he fought for the South Carolina 33rd. He would write letters in protest to a Congress and to the presidents via newspapers saying, "I protest the unequal treatment of Civil War soldiers, their unequal pay, the kind of racist treatment that they're subjected to. This simply is not fair." So through his literacy, he was trying to bring about social change. Once the war ended, Langley had to make a decision whether to return to Vermont and live a life as a Vermont farmer or try to foster change and healing post-Civil War. He chose to go to South Carolina. And there he worked closely with the Reconstruction legislature. And he became a superintendent of the school system in Beaufort, South Carolina. But by 1870, the white redeemers forced their way back into office. Langley was marginalized. He was actually charged with a political crime of corruption, political corruption, which was false, totally. But he was imprisoned for a while and then he was let out of jail. And he found his way over to Beaufort, South Carolina, where he lived, and became an assistant lighthouse keeper. Not even the lighthouse keeper, but an assistant lighthouse keeper. And that's where he finished his days.
What a hard right turn from what he had hoped to do to where he ended up. That's heartbreaking. If you're just joining us, we are learning about prominent Black figures in Vermont's history with Bill Hart, a professor emeritus at Middlebury College. Bill, a few weeks ago, we hosted a conversation on Vermont Edition with Black politicians in our region who work in city and state government. Can you tell us a bit about the first Black legislator in Vermont? It's a rather interesting story, if I remember correctly.
Happy to. Absolutely. It's a fascinating story. In fact, I'm have a book in progress on him. His name is Alexander Twilight, and he was elected to the state legislature in 1831. 36. Many of your listeners might know his story. Born in Orange County in 1795, raised in Corinth, and in 1821 enrolled in Middlebury College, graduated in 1823. As you suggest, it is a curious fact because for the longest time, Twilight was not recognized as the first Black legislator elected to the State House. It was thought that the first one was William Anderson, elected in 1944,
Wow, so a whole century later.
a whole century later. Middlebury had a college president named John Thomas, and he said, no, it was Alexander Twilight.
Did Alexander Twilight identify as black himself?
That is difficult to say. The record does not suggest that he identified or was identified as black during his lifetime. There are rumors floating around during his lifetime that say, well, yeah, the Twilights were a colored family, but Twilight was one quarter African American. What I find interesting, though, and this is what I'm writing about, is that William Anderson was one eighth black, but he identified as black. Now, why is that so? As of the late 19th century, the one drop rule of ancestry determined your ancestry. If you have one black ancestor, you're black. If you have one native ancestor, you're native. If you have one Asian ancestor, you're Asian.
Many of these laws that govern our society based on kind of arbitrary rules about race have been repealed. But hearing you talk about this, about these two men's stories, I do hear some echoes of conversations about race that we still have today.
I think there's much more room today for individuals who are biracial or multiracial to identify as such. We can do so now in the census. Couldn't do that until just a couple of decades ago. So there is more room now for us to be more comfortable with racial ambiguity and let other people decide how they want to identify. But at the same time, I think this one-drop rule has also been internalized by African Americans because of a shared racial history and experience of discrimination, racial violence, and so on. So, I have cousins, and I'm sure you know people as well who are very fair and could identify multiply, but they choose to identify as African American because of their a racial heritage that they share with other Black people. So in one way, yeah, we are making room for difference and multiplicity, but on the other hand, I think this one-drop rule has been eternalized. And I don't mean to say for a bad reason, I think it's for a good reason, where people of wide range of phenotype, if I can use that word, identify as Black.
So, Bill, you're working on a book about Alexander Twilight. You're also working on a documentary film with others in Vermont. It sounds like your retirement has been pretty busy, huh?
And my mother would say, I haven't figured out retirement yet. So that's, yes, I've been pretty busy with the book and the documentary film. And I've been serving on the board of the Middlebury New Filmmakers Festival. We just celebrated 10 years and serving on the board of the Old Stonehouse Museum and Historic Village, where Twilight lived from 29 till 57. 2025 is an exciting time because they're celebrating the 100th anniversary this summer. The theme for the centennial is Neighbor to Neighbor, 100 years of Orleans County history. So Old Stonehouse Day in August of 2025 will be a big celebration of that. So yes, I've had an exciting time serving on this board as well.
Bill Hart is a professor emeritus of history at Middlebury College and the college's first director of their Black Studies program. Bill, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a delight.
Today is the fourth and final installment of our February series honoring Black History Month. One way history is often passed down is through music. Dr. Kathy Bullock is a visiting professor of music at Bennington College. She's also a singer, arranger, and choral conductor who specializes in gospel, spirituals, and classical works by composers from the African diaspora. And she's teaching a really unique course this semester. We spoke recently, and our conversation began with Kathy telling me a little bit about herself.
I'm a visiting professor at Bennington. I'm a professor emeritus of music from Berea College in Berea, Kentucky, where I was there for like 31 years or so. And then I'm retired. So I have to just have to say it like that. So I'm very happy. And then a friend of mine, Carrie, who teaches here at Bennington, invited me to be a replacement for her while she went on sabbatical. So I came, and then after that year was over, then I was invited to come back to do a semester and then come back. And here I'm come back again. This is my fourth time back at Bennington.
Wow.
So I'm doing the one class, which is gospel music, or music really about protest and praise, sometimes I call it, or music of, there's a song, Joy in Resistance, and that sort of formulates the way my thinking about this music.
What the world needs now is joy and resistance.
All we need is faith.
They really, really are healing.
Right.
And so
right.
A lot of folks look at it that way. Just come to the choir if you want some healing and hope.
Can you talk to me about some of the earliest music that you cover in this course? What time period are we talking about?
I always want to start with spirituals, which would be one of the earliest folk musics in the United States. Some have been targeted as early as the 1700s, but primarily in the 1800s, during the time of enslavement. This music came about, people of African descent coming to the U.S., having the shared experience of hundreds of years here, and the music that emerged was this spiritual. Popular music that we call popular music traces way back to that. Jazz, R&B, rock and roll, country and western, hip hop, rhythm and blues, you name it. It came out of or was strongly influenced by the spiritual. So songs like Swing Low Sweet Chariot or This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine, all of those. So we do at least one song of that earlier tradition. And then a bulk of it is gospel music, which would be today's story in the 21st century and 20th century sacred songs of joy and praise and joy as a decision. You know, you can't choose what comes to you, but you can choose how you respond, and choosing joy.
When you say just that little 3 seconds of This Little Light of Mine, it like immediately made me smile and lifted my heart. You're a music theorist. What is it exactly about a song like that? Let's use it as an example, that is so joyful, other than the obvious, the words.
I do not know, because I would bottle it, Michaela, and just send it all over the world. Because in theory, it's about the pitches and the patterns that they create and how they work together. This is that, but it's more. I think part of it has to do with what the music came out of, because that spiritual came out during a time of enslavement when people did not know if they would be alive the next day. So it was a point of resistance to even say, I have a light. And I'm going to let it shine as a person who's, you know, enslaved. But those songs capture so many emotions, and those emotions are universal, and they're very core and basic. And one person said, these songs are so true, she can hardly stand it. It's about my truth, a truth that we share. When we say that, oh, hold on just a little while longer, everything's going to be all right. Or fight on, you fight on, fight on, you know, all of them. And people, if you are living and if you speak, you sing in this tradition, because everybody has a voice, and something about that collective thing that happens. I think there have been scientific studies about the healing things that happen when people sing together and they start breathing alike and breathing the same, and the heart rate and the slower of the blood pressure. There's all that stuff. And stuff we musicians, we already knew. It's like, hey, tell us what we don't know.
You know, if you look at the numbers for Vermont and the New England region, it's a very white part of the United States. Are there any challenges to teaching about gospel and spirituals and African American music traditions in a place that is so predominantly white?
Well, since I've been doing that for years, like when I'm in England, as those few black people that I see there, or I was just in Georgia, this country of Georgia, September, I did not see a black person in the country. I was looking, but they were all, everybody was very welcoming. And we did gospel there. We did it. I would say that people who come and are interested are wanting to learn, they're wanting to sing, they're wanting connection, and they are very open to what I have to offer and share. That has been my experience throughout. And I feel like there's a hunger that we have as human beings, especially in this time in our country, but in the world, for a sense of connection, belonging, and hope. And this music provides that from a people who use that for survival. It's healing. So I find that what I try to do is provide context about where the music came from. And then the stories of the people who created this music, some of the earlier stories. And then we sing, and it's always bigger and more than I think it's going to be. So that's been my experience. And I've been to Vermont now 8 or 9 years with different community choirs and friends of mine in doing this music. And I do summer singing camps where it's predominantly white and people come and learn this music. So I guess I've gotten used to that. That because many don't come from the tradition, I want to share and provide some things, and it can be a little challenging teaching some of the nuances about, but that's what I'm supposed to do.
Start with the basics.
Yes, start with the basics. And also there's the hot concept of faith, because coming out of the black community, my dad was a Baptist minister. So I come to this music both embodying it and living it, and also as a theorist, analyzing, educator from both perspectives. And as a person who grew up in the community, the idea of faith, of God, the creator, about that what permeates everything we do. So when I'm sharing it with others who come from different traditions, my challenge is, where can we meet? And the middle, where can we share the beauty of this music in a way that honors both me out of my experiences and you out of yours?
Are there connections to that you can draw between the types of music that you teach about and the New England region?
Well, there are black folks up here in New England, so wherever there are black folks, they sing spirituals. And there are gospel choirs here now, so they sing that. So in that way, those absolutely are here. Also, another project I did, I have been involved with, is called Songs of Slavery and Emancipation. And this is where Matt Callahan, a researcher who lives in Switzerland, was able to, took several years and found songs by abolitionists, white and black, and enslaved people in the 17 and 1800s that have been hidden, or they thought lost, or purposely buried, and brought them back to life. And we performed them, and many of the songs included the Shake Note tradition that comes, that's very prominent in the New England area as well as the South. And that was not a black music form. Black and white people sang it. So they would take these songs and change the words so that they dealt with freedom, and sing them. So being a part of that tradition and finding the way in which the message of freedom permeates so many other music forms, and black and white people together were part of it, makes me think particularly of New England. Because there's talk about Frederick Douglass at a meeting with about 2,000 people. They were waiting for the Emancipation Proclamation to be signed. So they had a runner. I think it was December 31st, or right before it was signed on January 1st. And so they had a runner out waiting. And when he came in to sign it, then they started to sing. And Frederick Douglass led in a Shake Note tune about liberty. So that's another connection, black and
Yeah.
white folks singing together music freedom songs.
Your class that you teach at Bennington is rather unique in that it also includes a singing and performance component. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, it really, I would call it a lab because it's a choir. So it's choir, and I provide context, you know, about the music we sing, and we sing it, and then we give a concert at the end of the semester or the end of the time we're together. This is a 7-week course. So we have people from many, Bennington has a lot of international students, people from all over the country, all kinds of cultures and perspectives and religions or not, or there, and just people coming together and singing this music, yeah. So we will, March 31st, we'll be jamming, sharing with everybody else what we have, some of the songs that we've learned.
Is the concert at Bennington?
The concert is at Bennington, 7 p.m., and it's free and open to anyone who wants to come, and we'll have a blast. And of course, the audience will be singing too by the end.
What about those of us with absolutely no sense of tone or pitch?
It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I start with the what I call a West African proverb: if you can talk, you sing. Because if you say I don't sing from that perspective, you say you do not exist. Because only you can sing your song. So we start there. Now, if you're in the choir and you have some odd new tunes, we'll help work on it. But when it comes to the audience and coming together, hey. It's all good.
So I'm wondering what it's like to teach to a group of students who come from not just different parts of our region and the country, but different parts of the world.
Mainly, they come talking about how their experiences, their lived experiences, and how this music connects to them or doesn't. For some who may have recently lost a family member, or have, for some of our international students who have family members who are involved in war, in war-torn countries, or some students where the college where I taught before who are very low income and they're really struggling day to day, or their sickness or cancer, or just the daily kinds of challenges, and how the music that we sing is helping to inspire or uplift them or encourage them, or they just have good fun and it's a release.
Kathy, do you think that the acoustics of performing in a church specifically, I don't know, in any way influence gospel and spiritual music or the place where these songs are sung? I guess my question is, how do place and music connect?
Oh, I think they do very absolutely connect. At the bottom line, we have the music within us and we share it wherever we are. But absolutely, the space in which we do it in does make a difference. I think if I had my judgments about where I would perform, it would be in a church setting, because there's a sacredness out of which the music emerges, or that is a part of it. Sometimes we've sung, sung in some very old spaces, and depending upon the style of music, if it's the old spirituals, that they did not have any instrumentation, so it was just their voices, their feet tapping and their hands clapping, then to be on one of those old wood floors and tapping, that, you know, it really helps it resound in a different way. Bernice Reagan, Dr. Bernice Reagan of the Sweet Honey in the Rock singing group, used to say that music changes our condition. And that during the freedom songs and the civil rights movement, people would march, they would invariably break into song when they know that the dogs were going to be sicked on and the hoses, because it changes your condition. Might be scared, you don't know what's going on, but singing. So there's maybe both the space impacting upon the song and the song impacting upon the space. I think they're both important, and they do make a difference. Absolutely.
Kathy, I'm wondering if we might be able to end with a song. If there is a song that you have been holding close to your heart recently, or teaching to your students there at Bennington, if you'd be so kind as to sing a bit for us?
Now, Michaela, I have about 50 of them running around in my head. Oh, Lord. Let's see. Okay, I just do a little, oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me, and before I be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. So even so, even so, God is still good. One was "Oh Freedom," which was a spiritual. The second one was a gospel song that says, "Even so, God is good," and it's one that deals with hope. And regardless of how crazy it looks, there's still hope and there's still thanksgiving for right now in this space. Yes. If I was the piano's over there, if I was the piano, then I would probably be singing something else like "Walking in the Light." Ain't it wonderful, too, how the light shines? Ooh. Oh, we are walking in the light. Beautiful light, ain't it wonderful? Yes, how the light shines. Yes, well, walking in the light, oh, beautiful light, ain't it wonderful? Oh, how the light shines. Yes.
Your joy is infectious, Kathy.
All right, just imagine all of us hands raised and clapping and dancing in the light, singing in the light, joy in the light, because we choose to do that. And there's power and there's hope and there's healing and all of that. Now, you see, I'm a teacher. I can go on forever and ever. So, McKenna, you got to stop me because.
Kathy Bullock is a visiting professor at Bennington College. Kathy, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Michaela. Enjoying you. Keep walking in that light.
We're going to close out today's show and our Black History Month series by revisiting one of my favorite conversations we've had in the past few months. Back in November, we spoke with the artist, poet, musician, and hat maker Toussaint Saint Negritude. He lives in the Northeast Kingdom, and his first collection of poetry, Mountain Spells, is now available from Rootstock Publishing. When we talked in November, he discussed his creative process, the beauty of the mountains, and what it means to him to be a Black queer poet in Vermont. Our conversation began with Toussaint sharing why he decided to put down roots in the Green Mountain State.
You know, I was always curious about Vermont. I hadn't been here before. I moved here in 2009, and I left San Francisco in 2006 and moved to Philadelphia. And I was there for 3 years, and by the third year, I was ready to go back to San Francisco, and all the places I've lived outside of San Francisco have never been more than 2 or 3 years, and I always go back. And it is a testament to Vermont that Vermont has held me for these 15 years, and I have no intention of leaving. Which is really wonderful. But yeah, how I got to Vermont, I was curious about it. And so from Philly, I took a week off from work and took the train. I just took the train up from 30th Street Station and stayed with some friends in Burlington and spent a week just kind of exploring. And as soon as the train crossed into Vermont, through Massachusetts, as soon as I saw the mountains, I was like, yes,
They spurred
this
something in
is,
you.
yes, because if I had gone back to California, I was hoping to move like up in the Sierras somewhere, like around Lake Tahoe. And I thought, well, this is close. So,
What is it about mountains that moves you?
I don't I guess I grew up with them. you know, in San Francisco because it's so hilly. You know, any view north, east, or south, you're seeing mountains across the East Bay or north or south. And as a kid, my mother would often, we'd take day trips up to the Sierras. And I've just always found a sanctuary with mountains, a real spiritual comfort, a safe place with mountains. And I appreciate how old they are, how much mountains like withstand so much of what in our cities and our towns we think is so important. You know, mountains don't care about gentrification. Mountains don't care about, you know, racial segregation. And just that withstanding, that literal above it all presence. You know, the first time I flew out of California, flew over the Sierras and could see the tops of the mountains above the clouds. And below those clouds, it's like storming. But at the peak of the mountains, above the clouds, it's sunny and blue sky. And that's always been a metaphor for me, a guidance.
Just how you just brought up some big social issues that face us today in the United States: gentrification, racism. And I wanted to get your thoughts on an event that you were involved with last summer in Lindenville, a queer poetry event where you were reading, where there were a number of protesters outside the library protesting you and your work. It was an experience at the time that made you feel, understandably, very unsafe. And now you're on this book tour, going around the state. And again, standing up in front of people you might not know, and reading your work. I can imagine that might feel very vulnerable. And I'm wondering how your experience has been with that so far.
Thanks so much for asking that. Yes, it is extremely vulnerable. And yeah, life just seems to be becoming more and more vulnerable. You know, in my writing and in my performance of my writing, there's always been kind of a necessary vulnerability. Like I'm 65. I've been doing this since I was like 18. So I've literally been doing it for a long time. And, you know, it's always been nerve-wracking. When I was younger, it was so nerve-wracking that the papers in my hand would, you know, rattle like a snare drum. But eventually I realized that it was that vulnerability, especially talking about homophobia, talking about the threat of being jumped last night as you were walking home because you're gay, or talking about, you know, racism in the job interview process, or, you know, finding an apartment. And I have volumes of stories to tell towards that end. But I found that no matter how painful or nerve-wracking it could be to express these experiences, these feelings, these emotions, these realities, that vulnerability is what it is, what makes my poetry worthwhile. It is what really gives it its value. Say I play the bass clarinet and play jazz, and I find the same thing in music, and I think all the arts. Vulnerability is a requirement. And the catch is like how best we can maneuver it and how best we can share it, to liberate someone else out there who doesn't have a microphone or doesn't have an outlet to share their vulnerability. But yes, talking about that incident in Lindenville, where I was asked by the Cobley Library, which is my local library, one of my favorite libraries. And the Cobley had, June of 2023, had asked me to lead a queer poetry discussion group. Pride Month, you know, nothing unusual about that. And I did. I was looking forward to it. There was just a small handful of people that showed up. And the premise was very open. Bring a book or, you know, a poem of your favorite poem by a queer artist. That was it. So there was a small group that brought, their own books. And we were reading aloud. From various poets, from Audre Lorde to, you know, all sorts of other poets. And midway through, one of the librarians comes upstairs and informs us that the building is surrounded by a hate group and that they had to close the library immediately. But as they evidently were particularly protesting me, I had to be escorted out the back door. And, you know, my generation, the stories that I heard of the civil rights movement and the dangers, the toils, were more of my parents' generation. I read about it. I knew about it. I do remember when Martin Luther King was assassinated. But I never... I never thought that there would be a day where my life would literally be threatened.
One of the unique things about Vermont and particularly the NEK is, it's a sparsely populated place with some very close-knit towns. So if you show up to protest someone, there's a real good chance that they're going to know exactly who you are, or they're going to know your uncle, or you're going to run into them a day later at the general store. I'm curious how that dynamic played into your experience of this protest. Like, were these people that you knew or that you have encountered since?
I didn't know them beforehand, and because of the racial dynamics as they are here in Vermont. Unfortunately, all of that noted community, everybody knowing you, knowing your neighbors, that rarely applies to Black residents here in Vermont, or at least that has not been my experience. And so I didn't know these people beforehand. But since then, it has been so awkward because I do run into them at the local grocery store.
Well, we just got an email to sign from Bob, who's the director of the Athenaeum at St. Johnsbury. And Bob writes, "It's so great to hear you on Vermont Public. We are waiting for the audio edition of Mountain Spells, and we can't wait to see you soon." Yes, there is a lot of love for Toussaint Saint Negritude out there. Is there going to be an audio edition of Mountain Spells?
Yes, we're working on it now. And thank you, Bob. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you. I so appreciate it. We're working on a Samantha with Rootstock Publishing. We're putting plans together now for an audio book. That we hope to have available in the spring. So we're working on it. I'm excited about that. And also, I actually have a full-length album that I recorded a couple years ago to be pressed on vinyl, and it's so much poetry and music that the plan is to have it pressed as a double album. And I've had a band called Jaguar Stereo that's a duo of an upright bass player by the name of Gaylord DeWald, who is just fabulous, and myself, bass clarinet, and poetry.
You two must have the best two names of a duo that I have ever heard. I'm glad you've teamed up.
Yes, I love working with him dearly.
Toussaint, you brought another poem to share with us today. Would you be willing to read that for us now?
Okay. This poem is called Cosmographies in Bloom. One of my favorite things about living in Vermont, pretty much anywhere here, maybe anywhere outside of Burlington, is we have such a magnificent view of the night sky. And I love looking at the stars. And to me, being a writer, the stars look like some form of hieroglyphics or some form of cartography or language. And I'm determined to decipher it. And I came up with this word cosmography, and cosmographies in bloom. Down a song flowing north, amid the boreal wilderness of innermost transformation, appears the realm of the soul rising mountains of the moon at dawn. Obliged by the gods, down a song of stars and coniferous splendor, greens the calling of reaches higher than our shadows can modernly conceive. Down a song flowing north rises the dawn land of illuminations, welcoming the innermost of elevations to passages of expansions duly received. Behold such noble means of galactic introspection. Behold each peak surrounding each surrounding peak upon peak upon peak. Behold each bewitching reach. Behold this ascension of irrepressible peace. Behold your emancipation from all dominions otherwise. For here is where your unconquerable wilderness glistens in the liberty your passion calls home. Welcoming all illuminations to the dawn land incandescence of innermost reclamations, unshackling the sages from the ages, long now blazing and found. Down this song flowing north amid the boreal chicories lining the cosmos from the astral floor appears the realm of the soul rising mountains of the moon at dawn. Obliged by the gods of blossoming cosmographies, behold this land, your passion calls home.
That was the poet and maker Toussaint Saint-Negritude. All right, that is all the time that we have for today's show. As always, you can weigh in on Vermont Edition or pitch us ideas by emailing vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. You can also find Vermont Public on Instagram. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Anna Berg is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.